Good evening and welcome to another edition of Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. With me tonight is, of course, Mark Warner, and we have a jam-packed show. Now, I know I say that every week, but literally, this is wall-to-wall action, so we are going to get right down to it, folks. I'm excited about my next guest. We have on lawyer, writer, and political commentator for the Fox News Channel, Sherilyn Harley LeBond. Sherilyn, thank you for being on tonight.
It is great to be with you this evening.
Well, I'm excited to have you on because even though the segment is airing on Tuesday, we're recording on Monday, I want to get your thoughts on the presidential race. Obviously, as this show airs, we're waiting for results to come in from Arizona and Michigan. Who is it most important for to win Tuesday night's primaries?
Well, you know, everyone keeps talking about how it's so important for this person to win Michigan and this person to win Arizona. And, you know, you listen to the pundits and everyone's yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
But here's my opinion on this. Yes, Michigan and Arizona are both important. We know the facts on Michigan. This is where Mitt Romney's dad was governor. This is where he grew up. How embarrassing would it be to lose your, you know, essentially your home state?
Yes.
Arizona is a big state, but keep in mind there, you've got Hispanic media markets. In order to run ads, you need money. Who's the candidate who's in the best position to do that?
Mm-hmm.
But let's not forget, you've got a Washington State caucus coming up next week, and then we've got the all-important Super Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
So Super Tuesday, you're going to see about four caucus states. And remember, caucus states are good for people like Ron Paul. Why? Because he tends to utilize younger people who are able to get out and walk those precincts, and he's got a pretty good ground game, basically
mm-hmm.
across the country, which is why it works well in those caucus states. Then you have some major big delegate vote-getting states.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be Virginia, Ohio is Super Tuesday. Now, let's talk about Virginia for a minute, because Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich are not on the ballot in Virginia.
That's
true. So they're missing out on those delegates, okay? So
mm-hmm.
keep in mind that. Massachusetts, again, this is Romney's home state. We would expect him to win that.
Yeah.
Ohio, big, you know, large amount of delegates. Well, they say, you know, we don't know. Proof is actually in when it happens. They say that Rick Santorum is appealing to blue-collar workers. Okay,
mm-hmm.
That might lead one to believe that Ohio may be someplace that he's trending. Tennessee is coming up. Apparently, Rick Santorum is leading in Tennessee. So back to your original question,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've got all these Super Tuesday big states coming up. So why is it that everybody's saying, you know, Mitt Romney has to make or break Michigan, or Rick Santorum has to make or break Michigan? Sorry, I just don't believe that. I think that, you know, basically this entire next 4 weeks is very important for all of the candidates. You never know. Newt may emerge again in the South. We don't know that. Ron Paul may just absolutely sweep all the caucus states on Super Tuesday. We don't know that either. And then again, Mitt Romney may lose Michigan. Will that be the end of him? Certainly not. Do people think that if he loses Michigan, he's going to drop out? Mitt Romney's not going anywhere.
Oh, heck no.
So I don't know why people keep saying, oh, it's the end of Mitt. He's not going anywhere. He's got the biggest operation out of everyone. Why
mm-hmm.
would he drop out if he loses Michigan? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I just wish people would just use a little bit of common sense. He's not going anywhere.
Well, no. Mitt isn't going anywhere. But the way you kind of map this out, this sounds like this is going to go down to the wire.
It might. It you know, it really, it absolutely might. If he is able, meaning Mitt Romney,
mm-hmm.
if he is able to win Michigan and Arizona, Rick Santorum his money may dry up. Because remember, we see all this momentum going. You know, Rick Santorum had had momentum. Mm-hmm. And then last week with the debates, I think, quite honestly, I think he got too much caught into the weeds with appropriations and earmarks.
Oh, he did.
Then I also think that he's been veering off on the social issues too much, and not so much necessarily all of his problem or all of his fault, but the problem is he's allowed the left to dictate the narrative. You can't do that. You got to stay on message. And remember, that takes an awful amount of discipline. So part of it is Paul Rick Santorum's own, you know, his own undoing.
Mm-hmm.
Because he started to get off message. But when we saw that happen, what happened is he lost momentum. So this very volatile primary race, I mean, you're up and down and all around. And I think it's just the way it's going to be.
Well, okay. Here's my next question for you. You touched on something here about the Democrats controlling the narrative for Rick Santorum. And I totally see it. But frankly, it seems as if all the candidates have completely lost control of the entire narrative of the economy, the jobs. I mean, this week and last week, we've seen the news is just filled with talk of gas prices and how fragile this recovery is and how we can just as easily slip into another recession. And then there's talk of a $16 trillion debt.
Right. Let me say this. As someone who was a spokesperson at the RNC during mm-hmm. the 2000 Bush-Cheney election,
mm-hmm.
and literally we would be communications department, we would be pitching stories. Mainstream media would just hang up on us.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're not interested in us. So this is part of dealing with the mainstream media. And you know what, Josh? Sometimes despite them, often we still beat them at their own game. And despite them simply ignoring us, we can still win elections. So
true.
What I mean by that is that, you know, we've got rising gas prices. Nobody in the mainstream media wants to talk about that. The Middle East is melting down as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
Syria, who's Iran's biggest ally, they've got people dying in the streets every day. None of them are reporting that. You know why? Because they love this president, and they don't want to give the Republicans a fair shake at any point. And this is also exemplified by these crazy questions in these debates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this last debate, how long did it take him before he asked a question on the economy, this John King guy? I mean, come on. I mean, they really firmly believe that they control the narrative, and it takes a lot of discipline on the part of Republican candidates to be able to stick to their message and stick to their narrative, or else the left and the mainstream media are going to define it for you. Now, I think Mitt Romney has done a great job. Not a great job. I think he's done as best as he can
mm-hmm.
with sticking to the narrative. And quite frankly, I think Ron Paul has been quite consistent too. I mean, because every time you hear him talk, he's talking about bringing the troops home and spending more money in the United States instead of Afghanistan and Iraq. And you may not agree with him, but he's pretty consistent. And, you know, they're not really trying to change that narrative because guess what? There's not much change in the narrative with Ron Paul. He's steady Eddie on his policy.
That is true, and we know that's why he's Mark Warner's favorite candidate.
I hate you.
I love you too, Mark.
I hate you. I really hate you.
Hey, this is a family show. All right,
watch
the language,
okay? Oh, I'm so sorry, you true conservative.
Now, here's a question for you, Sherilyn, about Ron Paul. This may seem like an unfair question, but, I mean, let's be honest here. No one in the media is giving him any chance. They're really not paying him much attention. So it doesn't seem too hard to kind of push him away from his narrative because no one's really paying attention to him. He's got lots of money. Well, not compared to Romney, but he's got enough to stick around. He's got the grassroots support. And you're right, he doesn't waver from his message.
It seems like the
biggest attention that he's gotten was at the last debate where everyone was saying that he was Mitt Romney's foil to bash Rick Santorum.
Exactly. Well, I'm not sure I'd agree with you on the point of people ignoring him because, you know, Ron Paul has a very important constituency, and that's young people. Mm-hmm. And for the eventual nominee to ignore that fact would be very troublesome. And I think whoever is the eventual nominee really needs to somehow embrace what Ron Paul has to offer.
Wow.
Whatever that may be. Because I think ignoring Ron Paul and his constituency, and I mean all of those young people who are out there, you know, walking precincts for him and working hard, where are those people going to go if Ron Paul is not the eventual nominee?
Well, the same question could have been asked in 2008. Do you think that John McCain being the nominee lost a lot of those supporters? I mean, I can't imagine that if he had maintained Ron Paul's support, that they would have put him over the edge.
But you know what? Let's not compare.
Okay.
Let's not compare because John McCain just didn't, in my opinion, he just didn't inspire a lot of people. He did not. He was not the candidate that I think a lot of Republicans and conservatives were not really excited about.
But truth be told, the only candidate in this race who is inspiring anybody is probably Ron Paul. Because, I mean, the supporters for him, I mean, they are diehard.
Yeah, they love him. They love him. But that's why I'm saying, Josh, that whoever this eventual nominee is, mm-hmm. they have got to figure out how to get some of those Ron Paul voters. Because we need every last one of our Republican voters to vote in November. I mean, we need every last vote, every single one.
Okay.
Because I'm not sure. I mean, you know, I'm not a Democrat, so I'm not hanging out with the Democrat pollsters.
Sure.
But I just saw a poll that said even 50-something percent of Democrats believe that Obamacare is unconstitutional. Well, that's problematic.
That is problematic, but at least that means they have some common sense on their heads.
Well, let's be grateful for that.
My question
is, how many of those folks are staying home? How many of those Democrats who believe that Obamacare is unconstitutional are staying home? That's my question. I want them all to stay home.
Well, so do I.
And I want them all to be, you know, frustrated with the president and mm-hmm. say, okay, we're just staying home. And I want every single Republican voter to be out there. You know, we need to have, you know, 100% participation rate. You know, those exit polls mm-hmm. in order to beat this man. So, you know, that's why I'm saying that whoever is eventual nominee, somehow you have got to resonate with those younger Ron Paul voters. And, you know, I've read in articles that some of the party establishment, some political strategists are saying, you know, it would be a good thing if whoever the nominee is took some time to spend some time with Ron Paul and to somehow cultivate his voters because he has a loyal following. He has a loyal following. So let's figure out a way to bring them into the tent.
Well, there's no more loyal follower that I know of than Mark Warner. Mark, how do you feel about all this talk?
Josh, I am not a Ron Paul supporter.
Again?
Nor do I like the word wars and constitution. I get it. Ron Paul has a lot of loyal followers. But they're a lot of crazy, too. And I get what you're saying. And I do. I get what you're saying. But at the same time, I don't know. I just don't think we need to add more crazy to the tent.
We're a big tent party.
Well,
we need a little crazy, Mark.
We're a big tent, but
here's the thing. The crazies have a vote too, Mark.
Yeah, Mark. Are you trying to disenfranchise the crazy? They vote.
These young voters are our future. So some way, you know, if you want to call them crazies, then what you're saying is, you know, in 20 years, the country's going to be ruled by crazies. Our party will be. And I'm not willing to go down that road. I really believe that we need to bring them in the tent.
Well,
Eventually, guys, we're going to have a nominee, okay? We are going to have one nominee. And going into November, we all need to be standing by our nominee. Because
we
are looking at Barack Obama for another 4 years. So I'm telling you, tonight that I support whoever the nominee is, because they are going to be far better than what we currently have.
But you know what? The establishment is trying to bring, has tried to bring in, like, the Tea Party people.
You can't, and, Mark, you
hold,
can't.
Hold on, let me finish.
You can't bring in the Tea Party and stab them at the back at the same time.
Well, at this, I'm not saying that we're trying to stab them in the back, but they're the reason why, because I've heard, I guess my thing is we've been trying to bring people into the tent, and it's establishment, rabble, 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 rhinos, rabble, 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 and that's all we get. And why let them in if they're just going to rabble, rabble, rabble and call us establishment rhinos?
I got a big tent on this show, Mark, and I let you be on this show. You're our token establishment rhino.
Yeah, but
so how do we? So Mark, how do we define establishment? Everybody keeps talking about establishment.
That's a good question. I would like to know too, because I'm pegged as one. I'll be really.
I have the slightest idea.
Hello. Okay.
I'm running walk close next week, and it's gonna get ugly, but that's neither here nor there.
Mark, you faded out there for a bit. But that's okay. We don't need to hear any rhino talk from you. now, Sherilyn, you have maintained composure throughout this entire interview, which is a difficult thing to do, knowing that Mark Warner is on the line. But the one thing that I do want to ask you, because I think that even more so than in 2008, I think that whoever our nominee is, they are going to need a much more solid vice president choice than they have in years past. I understand John McCain's choice in 2008. I do. I get it. I supported it. We can't make, in a sense, a similar choice for similar reasons in 2012. And I know that Governor Mitch Daniels has left the door open to be a VP choice. Governor Chris Christie opened that door recently. Marco Rubio has recently reopened that door. Paul Ryan's name is thrown out there. And I remember in 2008, there were a bunch of considerable names then. Governor Pawlenty at the time was considered a choice. Congressman Cantor, Eric Cantor, was even considered a choice. I think the field for VP is a little bit stronger this year than in 2008. How do you see a VP nominee? And again, tacking on to that, what you were talking about, reaching out to the Ron Paul voters, you know, how do you see that playing into creating a solid ticket to take on President Obama in November? I mean, is that going to be necessary?
What's going to be necessary?
Well, I mean, is that VP's pick going to have to be, in a sense, I almost think that whoever is chosen who is chosen VP might even overshadow who the presidential nominee is, just because there's a lack of excitement about these guys. Just is.
Right. Yeah, you're right. There is a lack of excitement, and I don't think anybody would argue with you. I think the guy on the street wouldn't argue with you, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. The average Joe Blow on the street wouldn't argue with you on that point.
Mm-hmm.
yes, I do think they need to take some consideration into who this VP nominee is, because you do want someone who's going to somehow excite our base. And I think some would argue that when, and some would disagree, that when Sarah Palin was announced, she did excite a lot of people.
I was excited. Truth be told, I was.
Didn't excite people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of the names that are floated out there, I think Marco Rubio gets people very excited.
Mm-hmm.
He's young, good-looking Cuban.
Yeah.
He's smart. He is articulate. I mean, who doesn't like Marco Rubio? I think he would be a great VP nominee. He would be phenomenal. And he would, of course, be very helpful with that all-important Hispanic vote.
Mm-hmm.
In major states like Florida and Arizona and New York, Hispanics are the largest minority in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and they're a very diverse minority.
Mm-hmm.
It's Cubans, it's Mexicans, it's Puerto Ricans, it's Central Americans and South Americans. You know, it's very complicated. That's why in Florida alone, you have, you know, a dedicated Hispanic media market. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's huge. So that's the name that I hear that I think, you know, just in my humble opinion, that I think gets a lot of excitement. I also heard, in fact, I put it out on Twitter, there seems to be more buzz around Kathy McMorris Rogers.
She has really upped her profile lately.
Yeah, and she's from Washington State. I just frankly don't know that much about her. I know that she's a mother.
Mm-hmm.
I know that she's been active on veterans issues. Yeah. And
I've also heard that. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. No.
No, I was going to say, I think another name, and her name unfortunately escapes me, but the governor of New Mexico, she's also Hispanic, and I've heard her name.
Oh, yes. Her name escapes me. Oh, Susana Martinez?
Yes.
Is that it?
Yes. And actually, there was I heard there was a poll done last year that I was at our state YR convention. A gentleman who used to live in Indiana, worked at the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. He now works for BIPAC, but he is of Hispanic descent, and so he has an intriguing view of Hispanic voters, and he brought a poll of who among the Hispanic population has the highest name recognition. And politically, there aren't many. They're all basically in the single digits. But one of them was actually Governor Martinez, more so than even Marco Rubio. Now, this poll came out, I think, in June of last year. I know that Senator Rubio has really upped his profile since then, and I'm sure that he's kind of also upped his name ID. But she actually had a lot more name ID and respectability among Hispanic voters.
Right. So I think, and I don't know how old she is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether she's young. You know, Marco Rubio, I believe, is only 37.
Yeah, he's a young guy.
Mm-hmm. A young guy, not even 40. So I just think he would just give a lot of energy to the ticket.
Well, if you had to pick who the winner is, not necessarily your personal choice, but if you had to pick the winner of the primary right now, like, who will be our nominee? Who do you think it's going to be?
I can't, and I'm not a betting woman.
Very savvy move there. Very savvy move. Well, Sherilyn, I thank you for taking the time out of your day to speak with us. This has been a fascinating interview, great conversation. I really thank you for taking the time.
Oh, it is my pleasure, and would love to have your listeners follow me on Twitter at Harley Laban, that's H-A-R-L-E-Y, LEBON, and I would love to come back on your show again.
Oh, you will definitely be a guest on a future show. Ladies and gentlemen, Sherilyn Harley LeBon has been our guest. Thank you again, Sherilyn.
Thank you.
All right. You are listening to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. We'll be right back after these messages.
FTR Radio is from the right radio. Online at FTRradio.com.
And welcome to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. My guest this segment is Indiana House Representative Judd McMillan. He represents House District 68, which is on Indiana's southeast border near Cincinnati. Representative McMillan, thanks for being on the show tonight.
No problem, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, you're a freshman this right now, and this has obviously been a fairly exciting time to be a freshman in the Indiana State House. You're coming in with, obviously, you're in the second session here. You have a big majority in the House. You guys have a lot of control, but that obviously hasn't stopped a lot of action from taking place and sometimes a lot of stoppages. What's been your perspective of your first first term in the Indiana State House?
Well, obviously, coming in with the majority, there was a lot of things that that we weren't able to do, or that the Republican Party, I guess, wasn't able to do previously that they wanted to get done. So we came in with folks who had legislation that had been on the back burner for years, literally, ready to move forward with it. And we're starting off with education reforms and doing the things that we did in that regard, then moving on this year to right to work. It has just been a just one divisive thing after another, as they would tell you, but it's been really good legislation we passed. But the interesting thing as a freshman is everybody who's been there for a long time tells us, don't judge your opinion of what the legislative process is by what you see here. It's not always just contentious, but it's all we know. It's what we walked in with on the very first day, and it's what we've gone through since we've been here. So it's what we know, and it's what I've become accustomed to, and quite frankly, I'm afraid I'm going to be a little bit bored if we get back to things that, that aren't as important.
Well, speaking of issues that are important and that have actually apparently caused a little contention post right to work, you're working on two bills right now. One has already passed the Indiana House, and we'll get to that here in a bit. That seems to be the more controversial of the two. But I wanted to talk to you first about SB1, which started in the Senate, but you're a House sponsor. Tell us a little about SB1.
Yeah, started in the Senate and passed over there, and it's moving through the House now. We're making big changes to it. But what it is, it stems from the Supreme Court decision that came down in the spring of 2011 that basically said that homeowners no longer had the right to reasonably resist even unlawful action by police officers. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, very understandably really stirred up some commotion amongst property owners and people who wanted to be protected in their homes, because while we do understand that it's important that police officers have the ability to make sure that crimes aren't being committed behind closed doors, it's also important to recognize that everybody should have the right to resist anything that is unlawful. Mm-hmm. And so by getting a blanket exception saying that homeowners can't even resist unlawful entries into homes, it really bothered some people. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to come up with some legislation right now that recognizes the homeowner's right to be safe in their home, while at the same time recognizing the important role that police officers serve in making sure that there's not a safe haven for crimes to be committed behind closed doors.
Now, yeah, you said this bill stemmed from a state Supreme Court decision that was passed down, I believe, last year. Give our listeners a little bit of background on this particular case and basically how this legislation was born out of that, if you don't mind.
Sure, the case was pretty simple. It was a standard domestic violence call where the police officer got called out, and the alleged domestic batterer didn't want the police officer going in and talking to his wife. Mm-hmm. And the police officer said, look, I need to go in anyway because I'm afraid that somebody is inside that's been hurt, and decided they were going in, and there was a scuffle between the guy who didn't want the police officer going in and the police officer. Mm-hmm. When that happened, ultimately the individual was charged with, in addition to other things, assault on a police officer for trying to stop him from going into the home. Mm-hmm. When it went to the Supreme Court, that's where the Supreme Court made the ruling that said, look, it's just always inappropriate to interfere with a law enforcement officer, regardless of whether his entry is lawful or unlawful. Where I think the Supreme Court probably erred in that decision is by saying that it was inappropriate for any homeowner to stop a police officer that's doing something unlawful. If they had simply said lawful, I think we would have all been okay, because citizens shouldn't be stopping police officers from doing what they're lawfully supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
But in the instance when you have a police officer, and this does happen on occasion, who does something that is unlawful, the homeowner or anybody shouldn't have to sit there and just tolerate somebody doing something that's unlawful only because they've been vested with the color of authority by wearing a badge or carrying a gun.
Yeah. Well, I guess it should also be pointed out, especially regarding this particular piece of legislation, you guys have worked hand-in-hand with police officers in crafting this legislation.
Since it came over from the House, or from the Senate to the House,
mm-hmm.
we have had multiple meetings with the Sheriff's Association, with the Indiana State Police, with every law enforcement agency you can imagine, including the prosecutor's office. And we have worked very hard, and I think we've come now to a piece of legislation that, while everybody may not be jumping up and down saying it's the best piece of legislation they've ever seen,
sure.
everybody understands the intricacies of it, and they know why it's important that it's being passed this way, and I think they're satisfied with it, which is, you know, this isn't any different than what I do for a living as an attorney. A lot of times you walk out of the courtroom and you know you got the right result because neither side's happy.
Yeah.
And that happens with legislation a lot of times as well. If neither side's really happy, considering that they're both lobbying for their own interests, then you probably got to the right result.
True. Well, I think it's this particular case really did spark some serious outrage. I mean, this really kind of lit a fire under a lot of people who don't necessarily kind of follow this kind of these issues. I think that once they heard this, you know, refusal of unlawful entry, you know, yeah, you're right. It was the unlawful thing that really kind of triggered people, and they're like, "Wait a minute, what's going on here?" You know, I feel that my personal rights are being infringed upon. Whereas, like you said, if it was just a lawful thing, no one would have said, you know, word otherwise. And I know that Governor Daniels took a lot of heat for this because, if I'm correct, actually the ruling came down from at least the judge that gave the ruling was actually the one that he had just recently appointed, if I remember correctly.
That's correct. He'd written the opinion, and it was actually a 3-2 decision, so the Supreme Court was split on the decision that came down.
Mm-hmm.
But you hit the nail right on the head when you said it really raised the interest from people who typically aren't that involved. My email box, my telephone, my social media, everything just blew up after this decision came down, with homeowners who aren't often overly involved in politics, at least people that I didn't know personally be overly involved in politics, and they were just very passionate about this, saying, look, we understand that police officers have a job to do, but that doesn't, they're having a job to do doesn't mean that we shouldn't be secure in our homes, and we have to protect the property rights. And quite honestly, that's what this piece of legislation does, is that it does make sure that police officers are protected, but paramount is making sure that property owners are able to defend themselves from claims that are unlawful.
Well, okay, I want to switch gears on you now. And I want to talk about, obviously that's the legislation that you're working on right now, but there's one piece of legislation, that you've been working on that definitely caused a little bit of controversy. And that was, a bill, I don't know if it was, based on what's going on down in Florida or what had been going on down in Florida, but you, were an author of a bill in the Indiana House that would, apply drug testing to welfare recipients.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I'm personally most passionate about, and I worked on that piece of legislation all summer, and I'm excited to have it move through the House. I'm hoping we can still get something done with it here this session.
Well, what sparked this particular piece of legislation?
Basically just the notion, for me at least personally, that we have to get away from an entitlement system that intentionally divorces consequences with actions. You know, you and I make decisions every day, and we try to make the best ones because we know that our decisions will have consequences. And when you remove consequences from actions, people are no longer encouraged to make good decisions. And our entitlement system right now has basically come to a point where we're telling people, regardless of what decision you make, there's always going to be another handout for you. And I personally don't think that you help people who are impoverished by making it easy for them to stay in poverty. Doing that doesn't help them, it hurts them. Well, what we need to be doing is we need to be telling them that if you don't make good decisions, there will be consequences to your actions, and we need to lead them out of poverty by making them realize that, that those same consequences that you and I consider every day when we make a decision are going to be applicable to them as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, what basically caused people to... There seemed to be some outrage from some of the Democrats in the House, yet this bill passed on a bipartisan measure, and actually quite on a, by a wide measure, 73-29. But yet there are people who are really kind of upset about this and basically kind of force the issue that had an amendment added on to it, basically saying that legislators also had to take a drug test.
Yeah, and we did adopt that, and so this bill not only applies to welfare recipients now, but also to legislators who would have to submit the drug test, which I'm fine with. It is a completely different a different reason that we would do something like that. As I said before, you know, the reason that we're looking at doing this for welfare recipients is that we're trying to help them by making them make better decisions. Legislators aren't somebody who is taking something for nothing off the public dole. They're not people who don't have skin in the game. Obviously, the legislators do have some skin in the game. Mm-hmm. But with that being said, if we're going to ask people on welfare to be doing something like this, sometimes the best things you can do is lead by example. And I don't think there's any problem at all with asking legislators to do the very same thing and have them lead by example. And on top of that, voters do deserve to know if their particular elected official is doing something that would impair their ability to make the decision. So I don't have any problem at all with legislators being involved in this.
Now, is this modeled after the Florida law? Because I know that there was the judge down there actually struck down regarding it as unconstitutional. Are there measures being taken to make sure that this bill doesn't meet the same fate?
Yes, absolutely. It's not at all modeled after the Florida law, but it is modeled with the Florida law in mind. It's not just the Florida law. Michigan has attempted to do this. Missouri has attempted to do this. Florida has attempted to do this. There's some other states who have done some various things. And I spent the better part of last summer combing through those cases and the actual legislation and what the Supreme Court said in those cases. And so what I've done is taken the reasons that those particular pieces of legislation were struck down and tried to do our best to work around those problems here. So we've taken into consideration a bunch of Fourth Amendment problems and a bunch of due process problems, and I think this piece of legislation actually is designed to meet constitutional muster and still have some teeth in it to get the job done that those other states have been unsuccessful in getting done.
Well, Representative McMillan, I think that one thing that kind of struck out to me when you were talking there was that, you know, you said that you've looked at how other states have tried to, and it seems like Indiana now, as they're trying to, they seem to be leading the way. Have you seen that in your experience so far in your first 2 years as a legislator where, you know, Indiana has, you know, there's always been this talk of other states doing things, but now, you know, Indiana's trying it, but they're actually succeeding and they're leading the way?
Absolutely. I think we saw that with education reform. We've seen that to some degree in our efforts to make sure the taxpayer dollars aren't being used to fund abortions. We saw it this year with right to work. I think what we're really seeing is because Indiana has been so fiscally conservative and made sure that we are in the black with our dollars, now we're able to make sure that we're focusing on other areas and really showing states how a state who has been handled and managed so well can then move forward from that position. And I think that's something that's encouraged me to take on the drug testing legislation and hope to help lead the way there, because I have been in since we talked about it earlier. Since the first day I came in, we've been the state of Indiana has been leading the way, and then I think that's fabulous for us.
Well, Representative McMillan, you've obviously been I think that you've probably been representing your district very well. How are you getting ready for re-election? How's it looking for you? Is this kind of an exciting time for you?
Yeah, it is an exciting time. I'm anxious about re-election. I was lucky enough at the filing deadline not to have anybody sign up against me for the primary. And so far, I don't have anybody signed up against me in the general election. Now, I probably expect that to change at some point. I'd be surprised if somebody didn't file to run. But, you know, I have been doing the best I can to represent my people. And the thing that I get complimented on the most, being down here in southeastern Indiana, we're in an area where we don't get a lot of media attention. Mm-hmm. Everything that we get is from Cincinnati or from Louisville and not from Indianapolis. And I have just been using my social networking and social media as much as I can. And every time I go to a chicken dinner or a pancake breakfast or a chili supper or anywhere, I always have people coming up to me and saying, hey, we really appreciate your tweets. We really appreciate your Facebook posts, because we know now more now about what's going on in our capital than we ever have before. And I think that's what politicians need to be doing. And I shouldn't even use the word politician, but that's what public servants need to be doing. We need to be making people aware of what's going on in Indianapolis. And it's not a position any longer where we need to be going up and hiding what's going on. We need to be advertising what your capital is doing so that the voters can be aware of who they're voting for.
Well, I was just about to say, you have one of the most active social media feeds of any state representative that I know of, on Twitter and on Facebook. Representative McMillan, my friends, he is quite active, and I suggest you follow him. You can follow him at @Judd_McMillan. That's McMillin. And then you can also find him on Facebook. You're going to be inundated with a lot of information. He is active, and he is, like he said, he's informing his constituency. Representative McMillan, thanks for being on the show this evening.
Hey, not a problem at all. I really appreciate you having me on. If anything else comes up, you want any more information, I'll always be happy to talk.
Absolutely. All right. You've been listening to State Representative Judd McMillan from House District 68 of Brookville, Indiana. You're listening to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. We'll be right back after these messages. Stay tuned for more.
FTR Radio salutes some of the great Democrat presidents in the radio era. FTR Radio.
And welcome back to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. My guest this segment, we're going to be talking about Michigan politics. We're talking with Duke Over America, the host of that said show, Thomas LeDuc. And I know that our listeners, they're going to be getting a double dose of Duke tonight, because even though this segment here is pre-taped, you're going to be hearing them live in just a few minutes. So whatever Duke says tonight is going to be completely useless by the time the segment actually airs. How you doing, Tom?
It's actually useless no matter when it airs.
Oh! Toonses has an attitude tonight.
What's up there, sexy? My God. Well, thank you, Josh. Thanks to your, Robin over there.
Yeah. How the heck are you, sir?
Well, just coming off a very interesting weekend here in the state of Michigan.
Uh-huh.
Or as we call it, wink, wink, the Mitt.
Now, hold on. Is that just because of the way the state is shaped, or that's because who the state is going to be going for on Tuesday night?
Double entendre, which Mark will have to Google that and find out what that means.
He will.
So, we came off Americans for Prosperity had an event that they just, I don't know if they timed it this way or what, but they had Andrew Breitbart, Michelle Malkin in town, Ann McElhenney, and then because the primary is so close, Rick Santorum and Mitt Romney spoke at the event too, and it was a barn burner, kids.
So you're saying it was kind of a big deal.
It was a very, they expected about 400 people. They got about 1,200 to 1,300 in that room.
Whoa.
That's
more than the fire marshal wanted. But
there was some interest in that.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we know, Michigan is in an unruly state and could care less about rules. I mean, electing Canadians governor, I mean, that alone, that's just going to be a strike against
you.
Well,
she became naturalized after she had sex with her husband.
So, oh, gosh.
Wow.
Well, what do I care? She's on current TV. Nobody knows where she is.
She's spending time with Keith Olbermann?
Yes, and David Schuster out there. Wonderful. And just because I want to brag, I also got to personally give Andrew Breitbart a tour of downtown Detroit after the event.
Was he mugged like Mayor Ballard of Indianapolis?
There's a story there.
Oh, so he was mugged.
Oh, I thought he was for a moment. I got worried because I had to tell you, we stopped at a gas station really quick to get a water, and he was in there for 15 minutes, and I just had these visions going through my head that every liberal in the country was going to be building a statue of me. Because Breitbart had been offed in Detroit.
All hail Thomas LeDuc.
Yeah, and I was like, but that wasn't what I wanted. But it was a very interesting weekend up here, and contrary to what I'm seeing in the polls, where Mr. Santorum is within 2 or 3 points of Mitt. Mm-hmm. I just don't see it. I mean, at least at that event on Saturday in Troy, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit. Mm-hmm. And from people that I've talked to around the state, I've talked about 10 different people.
That's almost the entire population, right?
Oh, no, no. We didn't lose everybody to Indiana. Just hold the horse to Skipper. I'm just not getting the sense that Santorum's, you know, built up this much to where he's that close with Romney. Now, if Newt Gingrich did the honorable thing and followed his own advice, and he dropped out.
Uh-huh.
And through his support to Santorum, well, then that 9% would put Santorum over the top, and he'd probably win. But of course, we know that Newt can't do anything like that. So I'm going to be curious to see what happens here. But I think Mitt pulls it out, and it's going to be interesting, and I'm going to be up probably till hopefully 10 o'clock with the Snark Factor and then, you know, look at the results and go back to bed.
Well, answer me this, Thomas LeDuc. It wasn't that long ago that Rick Santorum was actually leading in Michigan. What the CPAC, H happened?
Yeah. You guys have been around the political merry-go-round a couple times. I mean, Mitt's got some money, and he's been throwing it. I mean, the ads here have been, you know, what you would expect.
So is negative campaigning working up there?
Really? Is it negative?
Hey, I think that it's pretty much what anybody would probably term it. I
mean, you're pointing out a record, and it's all. See, to me, it's all fair.
I think it's fair too, but people would consider negative campaigning.
Yeah, he's like, oh, Rick Santorum voted to raise the debt ceiling 5 times. Well, he did.
Yes,
you know,
but when you say it, Rick Santorum voted to raise the debt ceiling 5 times. You know, people are going to be like, I don't like the tone of that voice. That's a little negative. It may be true. Yeah,
that's a bit negative.
But that would be considered negative Michigan, campaigning.
Michigan has an open primary.
Ah.
Where basically Mark Warner could go and declare, you know, Republican Democrat are just stupid right before, and they'll give him a ballot. And so
he's going to vote S.
You're going to have some people crossing the line because, of course, this goes back into election time history. It's okay, baby. This goes back a little bit. Jesse Jackson won his one and only primary in 1988 in the state of Michigan because people like me voted for him.
So you're admitting that on air?
Oh, yeah, because we wanted Jackson to win the primary in 88. It was an organized effort, and we had a great time doing it. In fact, we did bar parties.
I don't know if I can have you on
the show
anymore.
You don't like Newt Gingrich for sitting on the couch with Nancy?
No, I don't like
Jesse.
No, I don't like Newt Gingrich because basically he walked around with a racist talking about how to improve schools, which, of course, you're going to improve schools with Al Sharpton. Yeah. Spending $100 billion of TARP money, which he said he wouldn't have voted for, distributing it through the Department of Education, which he said he would eliminate, at the behest of the most socialist president, to which he said he would love to throw out of office. Yeah, Newt. Okay. Thank you.
He's got you there, Mark.
Stop it.
He's got you there.
Newt Gingrich is as fraudulent, Mark, as you are good looking.
Wait a minute. He's not, though.
Hello?
So you're saying Newt isn't fraudulent? Because there's no way Mark Warner is good looking. Seriously, have you seen him?
Maybe I flipped that the wrong way.
I think you did.
No.
Rework your analogy and come back to us tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay, I could do that, yeah. That's not a problem. Yeah,
I'll never be able to rework it.
Yeah, well, you know, when I get talking about at the event here this past Saturday, Robert Stacey McCain was sitting next to me and started talking about Newt, and I went on a 15-minute diatribe, and it was painful.
You never go on a diatribe. Yeah, you're always so calm and with it.
At one point, he actually said, "We're going to have to get blood pressure pills for you." So I know you are.
Just like that, too.
So Michigan with its 30 delegates, and then Arizona, and it looks like it's almost a mirror situation from what I've been following so far this past week. that Arizona and Michigan are pretty much the same in terms of Santorum is within 5 points.
Mm-hmm.
He's within 5 points of Romney, and Gingrich is, you know, in the teens, and Ron Paul's behind them. So it's a little weird that that the two are kind of so close. But then again, I think about it and go, well, we lost so many people to states like Arizona, Florida, and Indiana over the past 8 years.
Yeah.
I guess it kind of makes sense.
It does make sense. Now, we just got off the phone with Sherilyn Harley Lebon, and she kind of gave us an overall view of, you know, basically now until the end of November, although non-committal to a particular candidate. How do you see? Let's say Mitt wins Arizona and Michigan,
mm-hmm.
which is entirely possible.
Mm-hmm.
Going into Super Tuesday, don't you think? I mean, he should win his own state, but still, momentum's momentum. Does this carry into Super Tuesday? I mean, is there any hope for Santorum left? Because I mean. I was talking with Brodigan last week, and goodness knows whatever he knows. But he actually, I thought, made a fairly good point that, you know, once you get past Super Tuesday and you get all those southern states, that's Santorum area right there.
Yeah, you would think that, but this has really been, I mean, this election cycle has been really weird.
That's a good way to put it, yes.
Romney has a ton of money. Now, you know, could Gingrich maybe raise his ugly head once again and, you know, become a factor? Possibly, because if Sheldon Anderson actually drops $100 million into a super PAC, I think Gingrich is, I think he's a fraud, but if you give anybody $100 million, they become a player. So,
but can
you
become
knows?
A player? He hasn't won a state since Florida. South Carolina. Thank you, sir. Hasn't won a state since South Carolina, but. I mean, anybody's been blown out in every other state. I mean, seriously, how can he still even remotely be a player this late in the game?
Well, I would make that argument. I mean, that he shouldn't. And if he actually took his own advice, like I said, where he was telling Rick Santorum before he had that 3-state win the week of CPAC
mm-hmm.
to drop out, you know, Santorum would actually be, you know, competing really rather well with Romney. I would say just from this, and I've been saying this for a while in regards to the Romney camp,
mm-hmm.
Romney's been running for this since January 20th, 2009.
Yeah.
You know, he was up there in Troy this past weekend saying, or his wife was actually saying that, you know, we started to talk about this in 2010 in an alternative universe. He was lining this up immediately. He was campaigning for people. He was raising money. He was doing the things that Nixon did. And when he was in his mode from 64 to 68, traveling the world, collecting checks, you know, patting people on the back, going and endorsing people in the 2010 cycle, giving them money to their PACs and everything. The guy's been running for a while, and this is where it's paying off. Now, could Santorum still do some damage? I think so, because there just is not that groundswell for Romney.
Mm-hmm.
There is not that, yeah, he's the guy. He's better than Obama if he's it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of how that works.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not enthused with any of these guys.
Yeah.
And I understand why people can support each one of them, except for Newt Gingrich.
Yeah.
But if I had to go and vote for Rick Santorum, Mitt Romney, man, even to a certain degree, Ron Paul, I understand it. You know, I guess it makes sense to me. And against the guy who's sitting across the aisle there with as President Obama to vote against him, you know, I'd do it all day, every day, including Sunday.
So as we wind down this segment, because I know you kind of have to hop off so that you can mm-hmm. go prepare for things. When the Snark Factor airs tomorrow night, who will Thomas LeDuc have voted for? Jesse Jackson? Will you write him in again?
My guy dropped out.
Ah!
So I'm having trouble with this, and I got asked this a lot this past weekend at the Americans for Prosperity event.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know, because Rick Perry was my guy. I wanted Rick Perry, and I kind of find it amusing when, you know, somebody's candidate drops out and then they feel compelled within weeks to pick somebody else. If it were close, I guess I could understand that. But for my money, the experience that Perry had, was far and above anything else that I'm seeing here. It just, he had marbles in his mouth, and it didn't sound too intelligent, much like Mark Warner in the night out in Indianapolis.
Too true. Well, we're looking forward to the big reveal tomorrow night on the Snark Factor. So, so I'm actually going to wrap up the show now, because I can do that in this scenario. Because
you can do that.
I can do that. So I want to thank my guests this evening, State Representative Judd McMillan, Fox News commentator Sherilyn Harley Lebon, and, of course, Thomas LeDuc, Duke Over America. Stay tuned for the Snark Factor coming up next. You've been listening to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. We'll be back again next week. See you then.
Don't speak like you used to. Where do we go?